Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the first John Antcliffe Memorial Lecture on British Politics. My name is David Runciman. I'm the head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at Cambridge, and we are delighted to host this new annual lecture series on British politics that has been established thanks to a very generous endowment from the family and friends of John Antcliffe. So before I introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, I just want to say a few words about John Antcliffe and that endowment. John was a student at this college, Corpus Christi, one of the reasons we're delighted to host the event here. He was a history exhibitioner here between 1979 and 1982. When he graduated, he went to work for N.M. Rothschild as a banker, and he was closely involved in the privatisations of the Thatcher era. Indeed, he is credited with coming up with the best-known slogan of that time. Not everyone in this room will be old enough to remember it, particularly the people in the front row, but I certainly remember it, Hail Sid, the slogan for the British gas privatisation. At the time of his sudden death at the age of 48, John was president of the Royal Albert Hall, but his lifelong passion was for politics, and he had just published a new edition of the Times Guide to the House of Commons of 1910, the 1910 general election being one of the most interesting general elections in British history, as interesting as the election that we are currently living through. Apart from his enormous achievements, John's wit and his wisdom and his kindness meant that he had many friends, and a group of those friends decided to establish a fund in his memory to support educational events in Cambridge for the discussion of British politics. At the launch of that fund last year, one of John's close friends, William Hague, then Foreign Secretary, spoke, and thanks to the generosity of the people at that event, we have not only been able to endow this lecture series, but there is also now an Antcliffe Fellowship at Churchill College to enable a visiting scholar to study the Thatcher period and to make use of the archive there, which now, of course, includes the Thatcher papers. And we're delighted to have Dr. Aaron Donaghy here, who is the first Antcliffe Fellow. So for all those reasons, I am sure you will agree with me that we could not have a more appropriate speaker or subject for the inaugural Antcliffe Lecture. As you do not need me to remind you, Lord Howard, Michael Howard, has been one of the most distinguished figures in British public and political life over the past generation. He was, under Margaret Thatcher's government, Secretary of State for Employment, in the John Major administration, Secretary of State for the Environment, and then from 1993 till 1997, Home Secretary. From 2003 until 2005, Michael Howard was leader of the Conservative Party and leader of the opposition. The 2005 general election, which saw Tony Blair return to office with a significantly reduced, but still significant majority, was in many ways the precursor of British politics to this day, in that though the parliamentary outcome of that election appeared decisive, the vote was very close, and indeed the Conservative Party won the popular vote in England by a significant margin, which means that the Labour majority was primarily made up of the result in Scotland, the result in Wales, and the quirks of the British electoral system, and those features of British politics are still with us to this day. Michael Howard, as leader of the Conservative Party, promoted two young politicians, David Cameron and George Osborne. And again, you will not need me to remind you that when he stepped down as leader, he was succeeded by one of them, David Cameron. So we are delighted that Lord Howard has agreed to give the inaugural Antcliffe Lecture this evening. The subject is Thatcherism today. He's very kindly agreed to answer a few questions after his lecture. And then everybody is very welcome to join us for drinks outside. If it's not raining, that means literally outside. If it's raining, it means we're all squeezed into the atrium out there. Lord Howard.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's a great honour to have been invited to deliver this lecture in memory of John Antcliffe. And I'm delighted that Rui Inácio, his partner, is here with us this evening. I can't claim to have known John very well. I did meet him when I went to canvass for him at his by-election in Greenwich. He was, in that by-election, a victim of the last spark of the short-lived firework display which briefly illuminated the political sky in the 1980s in the form of the Social Democratic Party. And his venture into active politics was a vivid illustration of the first law of politics. You have to have a large dollop of luck. There are many very able people who would undoubtedly have had a distinguished political career, but never made it first base in the form of a seat in the House of Commons. There are many who do enter the House, who for various reasons, often inexplicable, never get the opportunity to harness their abilities to the great tasks of the age. John fell into the first category. He would clearly have enhanced any parliament to which he might have been elected, but alas, it never happened. That loss was as much our country's as it was his. But he went on to play a valuable role in political life, largely behind the scenes, and as we've heard, he developed a very successful career in financial PR before his extremely untimely death at the age of 48 brought it all to a tragically early end. It's not difficult to imagine what might have been: a seat in the House of Lords, a possible ministerial career through that route. All could have beckoned. Alas, we were deprived of what might have been a remarkable contribution to the affairs of our country. John's political career developed in the age of Margaret Thatcher. His by-election and the subsequent general election in 1987, which he also contested, took place when Mrs. Thatcher was arguably at the height of her political power. A great victory over Arthur Scargill, so crucial to the future of the British economy, was behind her. The later economic difficulties and the troubled relationship between the pound sterling and the continental European currencies, particularly the Deutschmark, lay ahead. And so, for the most part, did the wider political issue of the whole relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union. I was privileged to have a minor role in that administration. I was and remain a devoted admirer of Margaret Thatcher, whom I consider to have rescued our country from a fate which was the peacetime equivalent of the abyss which we faced in 1940. But when I came to think about what I would say to you this evening about Thatcherism and what it would mean today, I realized somewhat to my surprise that it was far from easy to define the essence of that term. Was it an ideology? Was it a coherent body of political beliefs? Or was it really neither? To help me resolve these issues, I turned for help to one of the most noted books on the subject, The Anatomy of Thatcherism, by Shirley Robin Letwin, the mother of Oliver, who has himself, of course, been at the heart of the Conservative Party's policy development for much of the post-Thatcher era. It's a considerable work, well worth reading. I don't agree with all its conclusions, and because the search for the essence of Thatcherism has proved to me, at any rate, so elusive, it seems appropriate to start by dealing with some of the conclusions in the book with which I don't agree. Dr. Letwin, for example, conveys the impression that privatization was one of the things that distinguished Thatcherism from previous brands of conservatism. But although it's undoubtedly true that privatization was one of the great achievements of Mrs. Thatcher's administration, the theory behind it was not new. My first encounter with national politics took place in 1964, which tells you something about my age. At that election, I was personal assistant to Selwyn Lloyd, former Foreign Secretary and Chancellor of the Exchequer, later to become Speaker of the House of Commons, and at that time, Leader of the House. I travelled around the country with him, and one of the places we visited was Worcester, the parliamentary seat held by Peter Walker, who was his PPS. I went canvassing with Peter, who went on, of course, to fill many cabinet posts with distinction in both the Heath and Thatcher administrations, though I don't think many people would describe him as an arch Thatcherite. I've never forgotten that day. We met a lorry driver, clearly of limited means, who lived in a caravan. He told us that he was a committed Labour voter, mainly because of Labour's pledge to renationalise the road haulage industry, in which, of course, he worked. Peter patiently explained to him how detrimental it would be to his future if that took place. Suppose, said Peter, you fall out with your immediate boss. In a nationalised industry, if you lose your job, you'll probably never work again, at least not as a lorry driver. But with the industry in private hands, if you lose your job with one firm, there'd be nothing to stop you getting a job with another. Now, I don't think I could put my hand on my heart and say the man was totally converted to the Tory cause. But he was certainly given something to think about. And the reason I tell that story is that I think it makes the point that at least doctrinally, from an ideological point of view, the Thatcherite emphasis on privatizing nationalized industries was not a revolutionary development in terms of conservative thinking. And there's another point on which I find myself somewhat at odds with Dr. Letwin, this time on something she doesn't mention. If there's one word which might perhaps be thought to characterize Margaret Thatcher, it is bold. And she certainly was bold. But one of the most important, if relatively little commented on, elements of her approach to government, especially in the early years, was her caution. Let me give you two examples. I've already referred to her victory over Arthur Scargill. But it's sometimes forgotten that the strike of 1984-85 was not the first confrontation between her administration and the miners. In 1981, the government gave in to Scargill. I wasn't in Parliament in 1981, but I was totally dismayed by that surrender and remonstrated with many of my friends who were already in government. But of course I was wrong. The ground had to be prepared. Stocks of coal had to be built up. Other arrangements had to be put in place. That great battle couldn't take place until the terrain and the time were right. And the Prime Minister was cautious enough to realize that. Another example, again, touching on my own experience. I imagine that to many of you here today, the words closed shop mean little. But for decades, those words constituted one of the great injustices of British life. They meant that in a whole swathe of British industries, you weren't allowed to work unless you were a member of the relevant trade union. I came across one particularly heinous example while I was still pursuing my career at the bar. A trade union, I think it was one of the printing unions, which were so powerful at that time, but I can't be certain, had called on its members to demonstrate against the Heath administration's Industrial Relations Bill. One of its members refused to join the demonstration. He was fined. He refused to pay the fine, so it was added to his subscription. Although he continued to pay the subscription, he refused to pay the element which related to the fine. So he was held by the union to be in arrears with his subscription. He was expelled from the union, and he lost his job. Very shortly after the 1979 election, still not an MP, I went to see my old friend John Gummer, who would become a junior minister in the Department of Employment, and who had, of course, been a contemporary of mine here at this university. I urged him to outlaw the closed shop. My pleas fell on deaf ears. There were trade union acts in 1980, 1982, and 1984, and an Employment Act in 1988. Some of them did weaken the worst elements of the closed shop, but it wasn't until I became Employment Secretary in 1990 that it was finally abolished. Now, I'd be tempted to call this caution, of which there are many other examples, pragmatism. But Nigel Lawson has defined pragmatism as a weak-kneed unwillingness to stick to one's guns. So I leave it to you to find another more appropriate word. So we've looked at what Thatcherism was not and what it was, but not thought to be. So it's time to make a stab at looking rather more carefully at what indeed it was. And here I agree with the central conclusion of Dr. Letwin's book. Thatcherism, she says, has not got what it takes to be a theory. It's a historical phenomenon addressed to the concerns of a particular time and place. Its content was shaped by the response of its founders, above all of Mrs. Thatcher herself, to the condition of Britain as they saw it. In short, Thatcherism is anything but timeless. It's neither a theory nor an ideology, but a practical response to a particular diagnosis of what was required in Britain at a particular time. It has no capacity to illuminate the nature of politics or civilization. Perhaps surprisingly to you, I agree with that central conclusion. I would, though, just add that I think it is possible to identify a theme which runs through much of the policies pursued by the government in the Thatcher years. I would define that theme as empowerment. The desire to give the British people greater power over their own lives. Examples would include the sale of council houses to increase their sense of independence, the encouragement given to individual shareholding, not least through the privatizations, and as we've heard from David, John Antcliffe played an important part in that. The statutory requirement of greater democracy in trade unions, to give trade union members more power over their own lives, and the first moves towards greater individual choice in schools and hospitals. And of course, in this context, it's also relevant to mention the lowering of tax rates to give people more power over the money which they themselves have earned. So where does that leave us in terms of what Thatcherism can give us as a guide to the challenges we face today? Well, clearly, if one accepts Dr. Letwin's central conclusion, as I've indicated I do, there are very severe limits to what we can expect. After all, Britain today is very different from Britain in 1979. Then, of the more than 25 million employed, almost a third were employed in the public sector. The civil service was roughly twice as large as it had been in 1939. Whilst the NHS was employing 1.5 million people. The nationalised industries employed more than 2 million people, and a staggering 3 million were employed by local authorities. It is a Britain that would be difficult to recognise today. Yet it is possible to discern some common challenges and responses. There was a deficit then, as now, and the government has taken decisive action to deal with it now as then. If we pursue for a moment the theme of empowerment, it's clear that that remains a concern and one that is being met. The reforms of schools and hospitals have gone much further than those put in place during the Thatcher era. though it could certainly be argued that her reforms paved the way. And there are similarities in housing policy too. And in one vital area, the reforms implemented by the present government go hugely further than anything the Thatcher government dared to do. And here, I must accept my share of the responsibility. When I was employment secretary in the early 90s, we thought about tightening the requirement that people claiming unemployment benefit, as it was then called, had to meet. And we took some tentative, perhaps timid would be a better word, steps in that direction. But we concluded that anything more radical would be politically impossible. In our defense, or perhaps mitigation, unemployment was rising at the time, and that did provide a difficult background against which to make radical changes. But with the benefit of hindsight, I certainly think we could and should have done more. So I am an unqualified admirer of what Ian Duncan Smith is doing at the Department of Work and Pensions, and I'm sure Margaret Thatcher would be too. What would she have done about Europe? You will obviously expect me to say something on that topic, so let me give you my take on it. First of all, I don't think anyone can know what she would have done. We can only guess. So here's my guess. It's clear that she was not and would not be content with the European Union as it exists today. She would certainly want to change the terms of Britain's membership. But would she want to pull out altogether? I think not, at least not without having a real go at reforming it. And she would have seen, as I hope and believe David Cameron will see when he begins his renegotiation, that in any attempt at reform, the position of the United Kingdom is very much stronger than many people suppose. Because the European Union today is in turmoil. You don't only have the problem of the Greek economy, which is very far from being resolved. You don't only have the problems posed by the rise of parties like Podemos in Spain, which can be expected to pursue demands similar to those made by the new Greek government if it is elected later this year. You don't only have the dire economic performance of the Eurozone as a whole. The cumulative consequences of all these are really serious. And there are political challenges at the very heart of the European Union. France has presidential elections in 2017. The leading candidates are Marine Le Pen, who wants to take France out of the European Union altogether, and Nicolas Sarkozy, who wants to repatriate 50% of Europe's competences, a demand far more radical than anything suggested by Mr. Cameron. The EU would no doubt be able to survive without the United Kingdom, as the European Community did before we entered, but it is, to put it mildly, very doubtful if it could survive without France. So the need for the cool, calm voice of reason, which the United Kingdom has usually managed to project on the European stage, has never been greater. In my view, this means that the United Kingdom is in a strong position when it comes to negotiating reform. Margaret Thatcher would have recognized that and would have acted accordingly. I'm confident that David Cameron will too. So to summarize, Thatcherism was not a theory of government, nor was it an ideology. It was a practical response to the problems facing Britain at a particular time. In my view, that doesn't mean that it was in any way out of kilter with traditional conservative attitudes. On the contrary, that kind of approach has been typical of conservatism down the decades. It's an approach which I believe the current Conservative Party has been following. I believe the country has benefited greatly from that approach, and I very much hope that it will continue to benefit from it for many years to come. Thank you for listening. Would you have, you're up here, so you might as well take charge.
Okay. So we have time for a few questions. Who would like to start? We have a microphone which will be passed around. So we'll start at the front and work back.
Do you think Thatcher's in any way responsible for the rising inequality today? And do you even think that's a problem?
Well, first of all, I challenge your assumption. We had a seminar earlier today when David reminded me of the term for inequality of income, which is the Gini coefficient. Thank you very much. I learned from the professor. And the Gini coefficient shows that since 1986, income inequality in the UK has actually diminished. So despite a lot of what you read, I believe your assumption to be incorrect. As far as I'm concerned, and this is a personal view which wouldn't be shared by everyone, there is something which I care about more than inequality, and that's poverty. I care much more about reducing and alleviating poverty than I care about inequality. And if, and it's not necessarily the case, because as I've said, inequality has not been increasing, but if you can best tackle poverty by increasing the growth in your economy, even if that involves a degree of inequality, which it may not, I would be prepared to contemplate that in order to deal with the much greater evil of poverty. So I don't think inequality has been increasing, but even if it was, if it helped us to deal with poverty, I wouldn't be too worried about it.
So obviously Thatcher, as you said, would have been all for reform of the EU, but within the party, the Conservative Party, there's obviously been a lot of schisms over the years. Do you think an in-out referendum could heal that in any way, or would there still be an issue? Would it put it to bed, essentially?
Well, I think it would. The whole point of having a referendum is to put it to bed. So I've no doubt that there would be a difficult period during the referendum itself when no doubt many Conservatives and people in all parties could be found campaigning on both sides. But if we have a referendum that does put the issue to bed, then I hope that people can come together and start to focus on other things.
Thank you. Margaret Thatcher had quite a remarkable record for promoting colleagues who weren't particularly Thatcherite. She promoted, of course, a few like yourself who perhaps would be. But I'm wondering what are the lessons of that for today, and perhaps more broadly, as we talk about sofa government, what cabinet government was like then, and what we should think about that in relation to today.
Well, on your first point, you know, you have to have a government of all the talents, and you have to try and be inclusive and bring together people from different sections of your party. All parties are coalitions within themselves, and you have to try and make sure that every section of the party is properly recognised in your cabinet or shadow cabinet. She did believe in cabinet government. There's no question about it. That, she had strong views, and she would sometimes not hesitate to make it clear what her views were in a cabinet discussion. But there was proper cabinet discussion. And I can remember certain issues when there was a complete division on one issue in particular. And she said, well, you know, there's such a division here that I'm not going to, in effect, use a casting vote one way or another. You go off and think about it again. So there was no doubt at all cabinet government really worked during her administration.
It,
Yes, one definition of Thatcherism is the strong economy the free economy and the strong state. Now, you've discussed the free economy. So far as the strong state is concerned, the current government has got plans to substantially reduce military spending, substantially reduce police spending. I'm just wondering what you think Margaret Thatcher might have made of that.
Well, I don't think she would have equated the amount of money you spend with the effectiveness of the results. And so I'm obviously not privy to the government's detailed spending plans, which have yet to be announced. But I think what has happened in the last 5 years demonstrates to a remarkable extent how you can continue to deliver good government, strong government, while spending less in real terms. So I think she would have been the first to say that spending more money isn't necessarily the same as better or stronger government.
Hello, thank you very much for your talk. Both Peter Mandelson and David Cameron have said, we are all Thatcherites now. And Simon Jenkins described the succession of prime ministers since as being Thatcher's sons. To what extent do you think we do now live in a post-Thatcherite consensus? Which would be somewhat ironic, given Thatcher's intense dislike of the notion of consensus.
Well, I'd be very surprised if Mr. Edward Miliband agree with the notion that we're all Thatcherites now. My view is that the gulf between the two main parties today is bigger than it has been since 1983, which was the year I entered the House of Commons, when Margaret Thatcher was leader of the Conservative Party and Michael Foot was leader of the Labour Party. You may have been able to put that argument in the context of New Labour. But Mr. Miliband is not New Labour. He's something very different. And he and the current Labour Party are certainly not part of any post-Thatcherite consensus.
Hi, I was wondering if you could say a few words about what you think Thatcher's legacy in Northern Ireland has been?
Well, she took the first steps. She took the first steps. There are triumph has many fathers and failure has none. And many people have claimed the credit for starting the process of reconciliation in Northern Ireland, which has taken us to where we are today. But she undoubtedly took the first steps. And the Anglo-Irish Agreement was a very considerable step forward. And I think history will regard that as something, one of the many things, for which she deserves great credit.
Thank you. I would be very grateful if you could comment on your views about the possible impact of secessionism and changes in Scotland with reference to the rest of the United Kingdom.
Well, what can I say? We had a referendum. There was a decisive vote in that referendum in favour of the union. And I hope that nothing will happen to disturb that decisive outcome. I'm a strong supporter of the union. We are probably in for quite a complicated time if there are going to be many members of parliament in the next parliament representing the Scottish National Party. And no doubt they would seek to exploit their position to the greatest possible extent. But although I know that they'll be making a lot of trouble, I hope that the decisive vote in favour of remaining in the union will remain the separate view of the people of Scotland.
You mentioned that if Margaret Thatcher around today, she would support the notion of renegotiating terms of membership of the European Union. Could you give us an example or two of the kind of things that you'd be looking for?
I think it would be very difficult to do that. I mean, I don't know. I can tell you what and tell you what I would like to see.
That was the point of the question.
Okay. Okay. Well, for 20 years, I've been arguing for a more flexible European Union, by which I mean not every member state should be required to sign up to everything that is agreed. We have the precedent. Not every member state has signed up to membership of the Eurozone. Not every member state has signed up to membership of Schengen. And we obtained an opt-out from the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty at the time that that was negotiated. So there are precedents for the view that not everybody has to sign up to everything. And that means that those countries who wish to integrate more deeply should be allowed to do so. I'm fed up of the UK saying no to our European partners, saying no, you can't do this and no, you can't do that. I don't want to stop them doing what they want to do, as long as they don't make us do what we don't want to do. And so I would like to see a much more flexible structure in which those who wish to integrate more closely can do so, and those who prefer a less close relationship can remain members of the European Union with that greater freedom and that greater flexibility. And I think that is a model of cooperation which would work, which would work much more effectively than the current flawed model, and which could even be a model for closer groupings of nations in other parts of the world.
Margaret Thatcher has been both an inspirational figure and a hate figure to a quite remarkable extent over the past at least 30 or even more years. Now she's no longer with us, do you think that effect is going to decline a lot, or do you think she's going to continue to be a divisive figure and prominent in political imagination?
I think she'll be a decisive figure for some time yet. And she's a divisive figure as well, but a divisive figure because the problems facing our country when she took office and for some time after she took office were so pressing, so urgent, and so formidable that she had no, there was no consensus as to how to deal with them. And she had no opportunity to create a consensus. She had to take action to deal with them. And that meant doing things about which there was no consensus and in respect of which there were deep divisions. And obviously some of the things which she had to do did involve quite painful consequences for some sections of our society. That had to be done. And so that's why she remains a divisive figure, and will, I think, continue to be a divisive figure for some time to come. Although I think as time goes on, her achievements will do very, very much larger in history than the criticisms of her opponents.
Thank you very much, Lord Howard, for being with us. It's been most interesting. Just to tack on to the question that the previous gentleman said about the relationship with the EU, that you'd said that you convincingly argue that a more flexible relationship might be in Britain's interest. You also said that you listed the likes of the Eurozone, the Schengen, the social chapter 92. There's been precedent for opt-outs in certain circumstances. Would you think then, rather than threatening to leave in 2017 or at some other point, would it not serve Britain's interests to maybe list off the things that we might like to opt out of rather than threatening to leave, given that there is precedent for this to happen?
I think the reforms that I talked about and I think the reforms David Cameron has in mind are not just in the interests of the UK. I think they're in the interests of the other member states of the European Union as well. I think it will make the European Union better for everyone. So it's not just a question of negotiating terms for the UK. But I think that there is a deep desire amongst the people of our country to have a say on what is a fundamentally important issue. They haven't had a say since 1975. A lot has happened since 1975. And they want a say, and I think they should have a say. And I don't think that in any way hinders the negotiations with the European Union. In fact, I think they will help, because they bring home to our colleagues that this is really a serious issue for the people of this country. And unless we can get a better deal, unless we can get improved arrangements, we will leave. So I don't see it as in any way being a problem. I think it will help concentrate minds.
Behind the column here. I wanted to ask a question about the transatlantic relationship. So Thatcher, of course, wasn't afraid to tell her colleague Ronald Reagan when she disagreed with U.S. foreign policy, as the Grenada invasion made clear. What do you think her reaction would be to what is perhaps the most striking rift between a president and a U.S. Congress in my recent memory, at least, over the issue of Iran and the nuclear negotiations going on there? Would, given that Britain is part of the P5+1, would she thought that it would be Britain's proper place to counsel the U.S. president on what's going on, or would she have viewed that as more a domestic U.S. affair in which Britain should not intercede?
No, it's much more than a domestic American affair. I mean, it is an issue which affects all of us. So I've no doubt that she would have given the President of the United States the benefit of her views.
Hello. You've expressed your support for Margaret Thatcher's economic policies, and I was interested to hear your views on her social policies, and specifically I was thinking Section 28 in hindsight. Do you see that as a mistake? Or?
Yes, it was a mistake. And attitudes have changed a great deal since then. When I was leader of the Conservative Party, more members of my shadow cabinet voted in favour of civil partnerships than members of the actual Labour cabinet. So I think attitudes amongst the population at large have changed, and attitudes certainly in the Conservative Party have changed.
I feel like a lot of personal freedoms in the name of privacy has been sacrificed for security in this country in the last few years, and I just wanted to know, what do you think Margaret Thatcher would feel about this and how she would tackle the security concerns in this country?
I think she'd have taken the view that the most important liberty any citizen can have is the liberty to walk safely through the streets of our country without fear of being blown up by a terrorist bomb.
Do you think, because the recent coalitions and the projected next coalition, that the current electoral system needs to be reformed?
I'm sorry, what was the
Because of the recent coalitions and the projection for the coalition at the next general election, do you think that there needs to be a new electoral system put in place?
No, I don't think we need a new electoral system. We've been through that debate, and in my view, the people of our country reached the right conclusion about that. But I do think that the unfairness of the current system in terms of boundary distribution and the grossly unequal representation in different constituencies, which are very different in size, should be remedied. It should have been remedied in this Parliament. There was a clear commitment in the coalition agreement to change the boundaries so that they were fairer. It's a great shame that wasn't done. It should have been done, and I hope it'll be done in the next Parliament.
Yeah, thank you. Just to follow on from that remark on terrorism, don't you think you are grossly overestimating the dangers and risks of a terrorist attack? commentators like John Mueller have calculated the risk at about the same as being hit by a meteor. And if we think of past terrorist attacks over the last, say, two decades, we can probably, in Europe, we can probably count them on two hands. Whereas the private freedoms you've just justified curtailing happen every day to a lot of people.
I think you should address those remarks to the families of those who were killed in the London bombing and those who were killed in the Madrid bombing and others who have been the victims of terrorist attacks.
So just following that, you would think that those families would agree that it is worth curtailing other liberties?
I think it's worth doing what needs to be done to keep our people safe.
On a similar point, though not relating to terrorism as such, I was wondering what you would think Margaret Thatcher would have made of Theresa May's proposed extremist disruption orders, which would curtail freedom of expression.
I think she would have been wholly in favour of them, as am I.
So I think we've got a few more minutes, and there are two or three more people who want to ask questions, so if we take a series of questions for that for a few more minutes, that's okay.
Mrs. Thatcher famously had a good relationship with the post-Soviet Russian leadership. What advice would you give in handling Mr. Putin today?
Well, it's a very apposite question, because today is actually to the day, the 30th anniversary of the day when Mr. Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. I think she wouldn't have found it difficult to recognize the difference between Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Putin. And I think she would have been a strong advocate of firmness in the face of what has been clear aggression by Mr. Putin's Russia. Not much mention is made of the fact that in 1994, Russia, the United States, and the United Kingdom gave assurances about the territorial integrity of Ukraine, in return for which Ukraine, which was then the third biggest nuclear power on the planet, gave up its nuclear weapons. I think Margaret Thatcher might have reminded us all about that.
Thank you. From an historical perspective, to what extent did Margaret Thatcher draw influence and inspiration for some of her economic ideas and beliefs from the more sort of American laissez-faire attitude towards the role of government in the markets?
I'm not sure how much she was influenced by American examples. She was influenced by some of the theories of European economists, like Hayek. But I think I don't think she was looking for an ideology. I think she was looking, as I've said in my speech, I think she was looking for ways in which the challenges facing Britain at that time could be overcome. And she was prepared to, she was very open-minded in being prepared to look wherever she could for ideas that would help her deal with those huge challenges.
Would anyone like to ask a final question? Have we exhausted the full range of you?
Just exhausted me.
This is the final question, gentlemen here.
In the search for a majority in May, should the Conservative Party move to the right and try to capture lost voters who've gone to UKIP, or move to the left and try and regain or gain some more of the ethnic minority vote?
I really think that those terms, right and left, are very misleading. I think the Conservative Party should do what it's doing. It should remind the electorate of what it has achieved in the last 5 years, which I think is very remarkable, because without giving you a whole new speech, not only has it tackled the deficit effectively, at the same time, it has been, in areas particularly such as education and welfare reform, one of the most radical governments that we have seen for a very long time. So it needs to remind people of its record, take credit and pride in its record, and explain its vision for the next period to come. I think if it does that, it can be elected on May the 7th.
That's probably a good note. So I'd ask you to join me in thanking Lord Howard for a fascinating talk. and for agreeing us to answer an exhaustive range.
Thank you very much.